What I'll make clear, what will become clear to you during the course of the paper is why I call Gandhi an eminent Victorian. Because I see Gandhi as located in the detritus of Victorian social theory and thought, and that's the starting point. We have a tendency to make contemporaries of thinkers towards whom we feel an affinity. Gandhi is one of those figures whose thought has been mined for aphorisms on issues ranging from the environment and alternative economics to an ethical politics and the placebos of peaceful coexistence. While his epigrammatic statements, what we need is less civilization rather than more, or that the solutions we offer are indeed sometimes the problem, to state just a few, are bracing, it is the genealogy of Gandhi's arguments that are considered as crucial in this paper. Gandhi's words may have a resonance today, but we must pay special attention to the historical context and its influence on his arguments, or indeed the diverse and now forgotten fields of discourse within which his positions were located. In this paper, I shall read Hind Swaraj within three conjunctures. One, the politics of empire and its relation to race in South Africa. Second, questions of mass democracy and the crisis of liberal politics at the end of the 19th century, so the Reform Acts and the opening up of liberal democracy. And third, the paradoxical relation of an anti-imperial politics to notions of trusteeship engendered by colonial liberalism, the idea of imperial citizenship, which Gandhi constantly invoked. I shall adopt the simple reading strategy of what Conan Doyle might have called the dog that did not bark to suggest alternative genealogies and contexts for Gandhi's most celebrated work. In the brief, random, yet at the same time suggestive bibliography that Gandhi provides at the end of Hind Swaraj, amongst the familiar names is one misnamed text. Gandhi was not very careful about citation or quotation. Sometimes it's not very clear that he even read the text. There's a wonderful essay by Patrick Brantlinger on Gandhi's reading of Ruskin's Unto This Last, and then he says the three conclusions that he draws from it are conclusions that he could have drawn without reading the text anyway. I recommend Patrick Brantlinger. It's a very bracing essay. So we now know that this text, The Paradoxes of Civilization, was actually a text titled Conventional Lies of Our Civilization, written in 1883 by Max Simon Nordau as a critique of, and I quote, the inherently false and dismal tone and tendencies of our age. More than a century and a half has passed since Hind Swaraj was written, but as yet no one has asked what Gandhi was doing in reading and thinking with the work of the founder of the World Zionist Organization, the world's second most famous Zionist after Herzl, theorist of the idea of degeneration, and close friend of Cesare Lombroso, who wrote his celebrated works on the criminal type. So what is this text doing in Hind Swaraj, and why for 150 years have people not done anything with this? Gandhi wrote Hind Swaraj in 1909 at the age of 40. He was still active in South African politics at the time and was heavily influenced intellectually both by his stay in England from 1888 to 1891 and by his local circle of Jewish friends. I argue that Hind Swaraj must be read as a late Victorian text, informed by the unease felt by liberals about the opening up of mass democracy following the extension of the vote through the Reform Acts in England. The figure of the disciplined Satyagrahi, dedicated to truth, along with Gandhi's disaffection with Parliament and the idea of civilization as an affliction, were all 19th century themes that appeared in Hind Swaraj and were prefigured in Nordau's trenchant prose. Gandhi's recovery of the idea of Indian civilization as an entity distinct from both a degenerating Europe and a barbaric Africa, which is the element that's again not engaged with by most writings on Hind Swaraj, which is the balancing element in Hind Swaraj, is an added element that is an attempt to distinguish India from the presumptions of colonial thinkers. This text then is not the much wanted critique of Western modernity and its institutions, but rather a reflection on both late 19th century distemper regarding the masses and politics, as well as the fallout of imperial policies of racial discrimination. Gandhi's message is also directed towards a crisis in moderate liberal politics in India, towards a group who had reached the limits of a politics of petitioning colonial authorities as also appeals to the British character. And here I'm departing from the kinds of reading that Uday Mehta and others offer, where Gandhi is seen as not within the liberal tradition, right? That he has a critique of the liberal tradition. Here I'm, my argument is rather that he very much shared the liberals' unease towards the entry of unwashed masses into politics. And what if we think of Gandhi as a late Victorian thinker writing at the juncture of the emergence of the masses into politics and the transition to a new kind of imperialism from an earlier liberal empire, which was happening in the late 19th to the early 20th century? Nordau's presence in the text, unremarked on by so many scholars, reminds us that the joining of civilization and degeneration, the idea of degeneration, was a major trope of medical, scientific, and social thought prior to World War I. We also need to explore the extent to which Hind Swaraj was shaped by specific concerns in South Africa, not least of which was Gandhi's location in Johannesburg with its dark satanic mines and the febrile atmosphere of crime, grime, and the underside of industrial modernity. As well, we must consider that the text was written after a failed attempt at getting the imperial government to stop the fingerprinting of Indians in South Africa, written on the Kildonian returning from a failed attempt, and in the midst of increasingly harsh restrictions on the immigration and movement of Asiatics in South Africa. Therefore, Hind Swaraj reflects an anxiety about presenting Indians as a civilized people against the racist characterizations in the South African press and distinguishing civilized Indians from not-so-civilized Africans. The critique that Hind Swaraj launches against industrial civilization would not have been possible, necessary, or indeed conceivable if Gandhi were located in India, where in 1909 the lack of industry was a bigger problem than an excess of it. So it's a very Johannesburg text in many ways. The discourse of degeneration in the late 19th century related to the transition to modern civilization, the growth of a large discontented mass of people, and the fear of crowd violence resulting from a combination of industrialization and the opening up of suffrage. It was the product of the Industrial Revolution, the consequent urbanization, and the throwing together of different classes of people in cities, all of which had to be regulated. The historian Daniel Pick has argued that while the idea of generational and historical decline had been present in Aristotle, Rousseau, or Hegel, in works like Max Nordau's Degeneration or Cesare Lombroso's Criminal Man, this process acquired a new meaning. Here, degeneration was discussed not as a religious, philosophical, or ethical problem, but as an empirically demonstrable medical, biological, and anthropological fact. A scientific understanding of the phenomenon was supposed to lead to the possibility of purification and perfectibility that characterized the emerging eugenics movement at the beginning of the 20th century, and there are unsettling resonances of eugenics in Hind Swaraj. If you read it closely, about how do you produce the best progeny, what do men and women need to do, not engage in sex too often and too young and so on. And some of these themes are, of course, related to larger concerns about celibacy and technologies of the cell, but a lot of it reflects what was available in the popular scientific, and I use the word scientific within quotation, domain in Europe at that point, as well as popular attitudes towards semen vitality and so on in northern India. Pick emphasizes the coming together of multiple discourses, from the fear of outcast London in the 1880s to the disenchanted new liberal perception of democracy and mass society and urban life around the turn of the century, at a time when social critique came to be powerfully inflected by biological theories of decline. These ideas were imbricated in anxieties of national unity as much as in the uncertainties of national cohesion. Lombroso's theory of atavism was intimately connected to the perceived fragmentation of Italy and the assumed presence within the body politic of criminal and subhuman types who nevertheless had to be accorded the status of citizens. And here again, a lot of Gandhi's ambiguities regarding who could be the citizen, right? Who could speak for themselves and who had to be spoken for, the Dalit, the tribal, and so on, they had to be spoken for. Gandhi's politics was an exemplary politics, as Aishwarya Kumar has argued. In France, questions of reproduction, along with the degeneration of the national body, reflected anxieties about the decline of an imperial race as much as about the intellectual inferiority of other races. The late 19th century milieu which shaped Gandhi's thinking, which is why I call him an eminent Victorian, was suffused with these multi-layered concerns. In India, too, liberals drew upon ideas of evolution and degeneration when thinking about the future of Indian politics. They drew upon the works of social Darwinists like Ray Lankester to argue that if Indians did not evolve along trajectories ranging from righteousness and masculinity to industrialization, birth rate, and so on, they were condemned to be nothing more than a dying race. You're familiar with these discourses, right? One intellectual trajectory involved regarding civilization itself as an affliction, a disease that was causing the wasting away of modern man. The central problem facing European scientists was the vexed question whether or not the progress of civilization had increased the number of diseases. Gandhi's exposition of civilization as a disease followed from this original idea of civilization as progenitor of disease. When he writes in Hind Swaraj that, and I quote, "It is not due to any particular fault of the English people, but their condition is due to modern civilization. The nations of Europe are being degraded and ruined day by day," end quote. He's drawing upon the prevalent discourse in Europe. In the chapter where Gandhi begins his discussion of civilization, he starts by quoting a great English writer, one who refers to civilization as a disease. It is clear that he has in mind Edward Carpenter's Civilization, Its Causes and Cure, a text where Carpenter argues that civilization is an illness that humans have to pass through, though he knows of no case where a nation has recovered. So when you actually think about the complex genealogies of Hind Swaraj, so you have Nordau, who is a Zionist, you have Edward Carpenter, who is one of Britain's leading homosexual proponents of homosexual love, as well as somebody who wrote very affectively about homosexual love. He's also known for the epigram that a pat on the back delivered often enough and low enough develops character. So Nordau expresses a similar sentiment when he writes in the opening lines of his conventional Lies of Our Civilization, and I quote, "The human race today is more discontented, more irritated, and more restless than before. The world of civilization is an immense hospital ward. The air is filled with groans and lamentations, and every form of suffering is seen to be seen twisting and turning on the beds." So you can see Gandhi is very much within the spirit of the times. He echoes some of these sentiments from Carpenter and Nordau, both of whom he reads, and cites or doesn't cite, and so on. I mean, they're present as interlocutors within the text. In Hind Swaraj, there is a segueing from diagnosis to critique of a Europe where bodily welfare has become the object of life. And there is a celebration of the times when men, and I quote, "wore skins and used as their weapons spears," is what Gandhi's words, "plowed their lands through manual labor, traveled in wagons, worked in the open air," and so on. Very Amish. This nostalgic description is in contrast to the reality of the moment. The increasing mechanization of life, which takes away human agency, sense of self, and volition from humans. There is little that is original here. Much of what follows from the central metaphor of disease borrowed from Carpenter consists of a random elaboration of its arguments. And in the longer paper, I show instances where he picks up on themes from Carpenter, misremembers them, misrenders them, and so on. What is interesting in Gandhi's text, though, is the movement towards a characterization of civilization as being immoral and irreligious. In fact, towards a word equation of simplicity. And I quote, "This civilization is irreligion." This is followed by some memorable non sequiturs. "The people in Europe," he says, "appear to be half mad. They lack in courage. They're intoxicated." And finally, the capstone of that paragraph on page 37, "Women who should be the queens of households wander in the streets or they slave away in factories." Gandhi had no time for the suffragette movement. And then there are remarks on how the suffragettes achieved their vote through use of violence. That's in the Hind Swaraj. In the text itself, Gandhi expresses concerns that arise in response to two factors. The sudden growth of Johannesburg as a city with the discovery of gold in the late 19th century and the consequent explosion of migration and the response by the emerging South African state to control this influx through official discourses of sanitation, hygiene, and order, in which racial characterizations are paramount. When the South African writer W.C. Scully visited Johannesburg in 1911, he was struck by the warren of slums housing Europeans of various nationalities, Indians, Chinese, Arabs, Japanese, Kafirs, as the black people were called, and miscellaneous colored people of various hues. This racial mix, characteristic of the political economy of capital and labor under modernity, was as much a cause for alarm in the colonies as the presence of a racially unified mass of the working classes in the cities of Europe. Gandhi was experiencing in Johannesburg what he never would have experienced in India: the maelstrom of industrial production, overcrowding of labor men and women who were physically separated from their families, and general perceptions of the decline of morality. Now, one of the things is, when we remember Gandhi, we tend to make this opposition in our minds between Gandhi the Baniya and Nehru the patrician. One of the things we need to remember is that Gandhi trumped everybody in India at that point in being patrician, coming from a family of princely advisors, three generations of them. So you couldn't get more patrician than Gandhi. Nehru merely came from a jumped-up bourgeois family, right, of one generation depth. So when one reads Gandhi, and one reads Gandhi through the fact of his patrician sentiments and that he came from a princely state, I think we need to factor all of these into our understanding. I'm putting the point across very sharply only because this has not been the substance of reflection, and this surprises me. Gandhi's offhand remarks about immorality and hospitals as a site of disease were intimately linked to the particular relation of migration, sexuality, and prostitution in Johannesburg during the late 19th century. The prostitutes were concentrated in central Johannesburg in an area referred to as French Fontaine. I mean, everything, I mean, it's a very English characterization. Only the French get up to these kinds of tricks. And it was indeed in French Fontaine that Gandhi had his lawyer's offices at 21 Court Chambers at the corner of Rissik and Anderson. So he was in the heart of the red light district, so to speak, in Johannesburg. The recurrence of the word prostitute 7 times in the text in the most odd contexts and ways, and particularly Gandhi's memorable and notorious characterization of Parliament as a prostitute, as you know, and this was the thing which he got into a debate with Annie Besant about, all arise arguably from these anxieties of Johannesburg's modernity. Even though syphilis was a disease associated with the white man and with towns, Africans as much as Indians were drawn into the discourse as vectors of the disease, and questions of sanitation, health, and racial dispositions to dirt and disease circulated through legislation circumscribing residence, trade, and movement. Environmental factors like overcrowding, the absence of sanitation, poverty, and dirty habits were all seen as important in the spread of sexually transmitted diseases, despite Koch and Pasteur's discovery in the 1870s that bacteria caused specific diseases. During the 1890s, segregation was introduced in hotels, bars, and trains in the Cape, and the process of removing Africans from the towns, as well as more general residential separation, began. In a petition to Lord Ripon in 1895, Gandhi expressed concern over the petitions that had been submitted by local whites, who were seeking exclusion of all Asiatics due to their supposed peculiar vices. The petition referred to, and I quote, "the dangers to which the whole community is exposed by the spread of leprosy, syphilis, and like loathsome diseases." He also cited articles that had appeared in the government paper in Transvaal describing the Asiatics as uncleanly citizens with whom syphilis and leprosy are common diseases, like the colds. The turn of the century saw Gandhi fighting a rearguard action against a slew of legislation that brought together these racialized discourses of disease along with the fear of Asiatic migration into South Africa, aimed at the Indian laborer in particular. Gandhi's strategy is interesting. Gandhi's strategy was to disaggregate the threat through separation: the Indian merchant from the Indian laborer, the Indian from the African, the rich and middle classes from the poor and indigent, the clean from the dirty, and the civilized from the barbarian. Throughout the decades at the end of the 19th century, Gandhi was keen to separate Indians from Africans as racialized objects of state attention. Parallel to this was his attempt to demonstrate that India was on par with the civilization of the English, stressing their common Aryan inheritance against that of the savage African. He resented the attempts, and I quote, to degrade the Indian to the position of the kafir. By persistent ill-treatment, they, the Indians, cannot but degenerate, so much so that from their civilized habits, they would be degraded to the habits of the aboriginal natives. And a generation hence, between the progeny of the Indians thus in course of degeneration and the natives, there will be very little difference in habits and customs and thought. Right? This was the cause for great alarm that soon we shall become like the Africans if this kind of legislation proceeded. A large proportion of Her Majesty's subjects, instead of being raised in the scale of civilization, will be actually lowered. Gandhi represented the effort of the Indians in South Africa as a manly, quote, struggle against a degradation sought to be inflicted upon us by the Europeans, who desire to degrade us to the level of the raw kafir, whose occupation is hunting, and whose sole ambition is to collect a certain number of cattle to buy a wife with them, and then pass his life in indolence and nakedness. Right? So you can see that Gandhi is not particularly sympathetic to the African. And one can say this is strategic, that he's trying to separate the Indian from the African in order to receive legislative favor and so on. But all said and done, these are his words. Gandhi appropriated, retained, and burnished the category of civilization as a bulwark against a slide into the realm of the degenerate. And as I've just spoken, the idea of degeneration is very strong in the 19th century. His efforts were dedicated to induce you, and I quote, to induce you, that is the South African public, to believe that India is not Africa, and that it is a civilized country in the truest sense of the word civilization, which he italicizes to show that, you know, it's actually an important word. Citing the British colonial administrator W.W. Hunter, he pointed out that the Indians and the British were descended from common Indo-Aryan stock and were not inferior to the Anglo-Saxon brethren. As you know, this again is a discourse that's very common. The first Indians migrating to California in the late 19th century, there are cases in the court where Indians claim to be white, are admitted as white, and then there's a whole reaction against that into the 1920s and 1930s, when the claim to being Aryan is no longer accepted by American courts. So this is a worldwide discourse of race into which the Indian nationalist and the Indian migrant participates. Gandhi cites pell-mell a litany of scholars, philosophers, and Anglo-Indian officials like Hunter, Max Müller, Schopenhauer, Bishop Heber, and Thomas Munro, to portray the distinct achievements of Indian civilization in fields as diverse as jurisprudence, algebra, philosophy, linguistics, and village organization. He doesn't mention the helicopter and the atomic bomb. That we should leave to another party. Yeah? As Sanjay Seth has argued, a great deal of Congress Party activity in India, both before and after 1892, was directed at persuading the English. Indeed, it was always presumed to be directed at an English audience. And Gandhi's way, similar to this, the Hind Swaraj is directed to an English audience. And this is why I find arguments which try and separate Gandhi from the liberal tradition to be quite puzzling, and they're not historically located. Gandhi shared considerable terrain with liberals in his modesty of goals and moderation in aims, as also the active loyalism that underwrote the other two. Therefore, as Seth continues, I quote, an essential device in this art of persuasion was extensively to quote English and Anglo-Indian officials in support of any argument. Right? So say, well, you guys said this. Look, we are just like you. You yourself are saying it. These arguments of affinity, both racial and sentimental, were made within the framework of the ideas of imperial citizenship, as well as the rights due to Indians under the Queen's Proclamation of 1858, following the Indian Mutiny of 1857. The second argument moved beyond the brothers under the skin idea to focus instead on a more legal contract of equality and obligation that bound the empire together. As Seth puts it, loyalism was neither tactical, nor was it a purely contingent limit. It was the very ground from which criticism became possible. Right? And this is an important argument that Sait makes. The argument for India's civilization was to acquire a different edge in Hind Swaraj, which is in the end as much an assertion of India's ancient civilization as it is an indictment of Western modernity. It was first created in a climate of differentiating Indians from Africans and claiming affinity with the Europeans. We are as good as you are, so the argument went. In 1909, the context of the failure of Gandhi's mission to England to stall the moves towards a racialized state based on individual registration, the argument about civilization became more aggressive. We are better than you, this version went. And this is, again, a strain within Hind Swaraj, which I'm frankly surprised that it's not picked upon. As Keith Breckinridge, a South African historian, puts it sharply, Gandhi's manifesto is famously the product of defeat, written as it was after a failed mission to England to argue against the registration and fingerprinting of Indians. The exaltation of Indian civilization arose from this conjuncture. Whether or not it was a compensatory move remains an open question. I mean, we can probably hesitate before making a functional argument such as Keith Breckinridge does, but it's still a question we need to consider. In the chapter titled, What is True Civilization?, Gandhi boldly states, and I quote, the civilization India has evolved is not to be beaten in the world. It's like the IPL league. While other civilizations have vanished, declined, or succumbed to westernization like Japan, and I quote, India is still, somehow or the other, sound at the foundation. India remains immovable, and that is her glory. In the Gujarati text of Hind Swaraj, there is a shift in the citational strategy from the 19th century reliance on British sources to show India's achievements. Here the claim is more brazen and places British sources in a subordinate role as witness rather than as mere evidence. And the Gujarati text, this Anthony Parel's text, which is the Cambridge text, is the one edited by Tridip Suhrud and the Delhi political scientist, Satish Sharma. So that actually provides an alternative translation, meaning that it actually glosses much more on the Gujarati version. So in the Gujarati version, it says, as so many British writers have shown, India has nothing to learn from anybody else, and this is as it should be. So it's a fairly strong statement of India's civilization, of the idea that colonialism was not really needed to civilize India, and that India's civilization actually put her above that of Africa. It's a multiple set of claims that are happening here. And if this was not enough, he continues, now you see what I consider to be real civilization. Those who want to change conditions such as I have described are enemies of the country and are sinners. It is difficult to understand how Hind Swaraj has been considered a manifesto against Western modernity. It is rather a celebration of Indian civilization born in the crucible of defeat, and therefore intent on glorifying India in much the same manner that the Hindu right wing would in later years. And this is the curious connection of Gandhi with multiple strains of conservative thought, the detritus of Victorian social thought, the Hindu right, and so on. This is not to suggest a straight genealogy. I mean, please understand that the argument is not about saying like Natha Singh and Prem Singh, one and the same thing, that, you know, that Savarkar, Gandhi, there's no difference between the two. Anthony Parel argues in his introduction to the definitive edition of Hind Swaraj that a whole group of Indian radicals and revolutionaries, including the Hindu ideologue V.D. Savarkar, are the invisible interlocutors of Hind Swaraj. You're familiar with this argument. Hind Swaraj, in Parel's view, is Gandhi's manifesto of passive resistance as both antidote and model. I would argue that what we have in Hind Swaraj is perhaps Savarkar's revenge, as Gandhi ventriloquizes the civilizational credo of the Hindu nationalist. This is an India without inequality, without caste, even without the grinding poverty that early nationalists like R.C. Dutt and Dadabhai Nauroji made the constant focus of their critique of British rule. Arguably, it is less Savarkar and the revolutionary radicals than the Maharashtrian lower caste reformer Jyotiba Phule, who could be a possible villain in Hindswaraj. Because Phule wrote his polemical pamphlet Gulamgiri, Slavery in 1893, against the iniquities of caste and Hindu Brahminical civilization, an argument that would have made him, in the eyes of Hindswaraj, both enemy and sinner. Gandhi resisted a cosmopolitanism of color and a politics of racial affinity for strategic reasons, clinging instead to the more general idea of civilization. With this strategy, he hoped to hoist the English on their own petard, which helps to explain the peculiar indigenous nativist politics of Hindswaraj, premised on the wonder that was India. Making distinctions also meant creating an idea of distinction. While Gandhi attempted to combat the stereotypes of the sexualized, unhygienic Indian, at the same time he saw them as objects of reform. There is a profound ambivalence in his attitude towards the masses. In this, he shared considerable territory with moderate liberals in India, whose discourse on and definition of the nation included people who were unfit to receive political rights and contained a provision where the educated elite had to represent and lead. Gandhi is severely critical in Hindswaraj of the engagement of the masses of Indians in excessive and premature sexual activity, leading to the loss of chastity, stamina, and most of all, masculinity. Right? This is again a concern that I don't think has been addressed sufficiently, that Gandhi is presenting a politics of the loss of masculinity and the fact that it is the excess of sexual activity that makes Indian men less than men, or Hindu men less than men. The satyagrahi or passive resistor had to be a man of courage and manhood who obeyed the rules of chastity, thus setting himself apart from the rutting masses. Gandhi's notions of celibacy and restraint drew a lot from the landscape of popular sexual beliefs in the North Indian landscape, where retention of semen signified strength as much as moral superiority. And again, you're familiar with the works of Charu Gupta, Joseph Walter, and more recently Sanjay Srivastava. Gandhi offered commentary not just on sexuality, but on intimacy in marriage. And I quote, "We will," and this is from Hindswaraj, and all the quotations I have here are from Hindswaraj, you can go back and check. "We will have to improve our physique by getting rid of infant marriages and luxurious living." And he continued, "Chastity is one of the greatest disciplines without which the mind cannot attain requisite firmness. A man who is unchaste loses stamina, becomes emasculated and cowardly. When a husband and wife gratify the passions, it is no less an animal indulgence on that account. Such an indulgence, except for perpetuating the race, is strictly prohibited." Here you find again traces of the discourse on eugenics as to the right kind of people, the right times for fornication, and so on and so forth. These statements accord with what was then the current medical paradigm at the time of degeneration, which in the words of the Darwinian zoologist Edwin Ray Lankester, created degenerate offspring through, and I quote, "the early marriage and excessive reproduction of the reckless and hopeless, the poorest, least capable, least desirable members of the community." The figure of the satyagrahi was forged within this miasma of fears. In the very opening pages of Hindswaraj, Gandhi sought to delegitimize the revolutionary politics of the Indian national movement. The fear that Indians would reproduce in their politics the degenerative effects of their life as laborers in South Africa was a serious one for Gandhi. Nauder lamented the absence of true conservatives, those who were willing to fight for the best of what existed, instead of always harking back to the past or wanting to hasten the future. Patience with the present and its possibilities, rather than mere dyspepsia or alacrity, was what was needed. As Gandhi instructed his impatient reader, remember the old proverb that the tree does not grow in one day. Right? And the reader is always being, in Hindswaraj, as you know, the reader is always being instructed to be patient. The reader plays Watson to Gandhi's home. And he's constantly asking the dull question. There's always a dull response for which he has to be gently chided and brought around to. It's also like the dialogues of Plato and so on. Yeah, and actually, the name you'll find Menon, Philip Menon. Menon is a figure who says things like, "Oh, truly," and "How wonderful," and so on, each time Plato says something. So I think it's a huge cross I've had to bear, which explains my spleen in this paper. Moreover, he lamented the loss of individuals who in earlier days had a sense of respect for the traditions and structures of which they were part of and from which they were made. Gandhi's suggestions of the use of soul force over body force and of principled engagement with the existing institution puts him very much on the side of order. This description closely resembles the true conservative that Nordau spoke about. And again, in the longer paper, there's a discussion of the ways in which Nordau is the interlocutor who's present much more than Savarkar in the text, right, in terms of his writings on degeneration, his notion of how politics ought to be conducted, and what a truly conservative, for Nordau, it's a truly conservative politics that actually provides the buffer against the rising tides of liberal democracy, where large numbers of people are, the masses are entering politics, causing revolution, causing anarchy, and a dilution of existing institutions. Along with Nordau, Gandhi believed that natural hierarchies exist wherever human beings move into a permanent union of interests. And you can see this was a theme throughout Gandhi's life, the idea of the natural hierarchy. Because Varnashrama Dharma, or the idea of orders, was something that was central to Gandhi's thinking, and probably one of the central disagreements that Ambedkar had with him, where Gandhi would go thus far and no further. And this could not be reconciled with the modern need for equality. Equality needed to exist alongside hierarchy. That would be Gandhi's position. One cannot have mere philosophical speculation that does not take into account what he calls social facts. Gandhi draws a fine distinction between discontent and unrest in Hind Swaraj, where the latter, that is unrest, is initially compared to sleepwalking and unenlightened restlessness, as people negotiate the state between sleep and wakefulness. To move from sleep to a state of being awake, then, is akin to waking up from acceptance of the present condition and moving into a state of non-acceptance. Recent politics have awakened the Indian to the proper state of knowledge, but this has led to the second kind of unrest that has brought about many deaths, many imprisonments, many banishments. And as Gandhi says, all these may be considered good signs, but they may also lead to bad results. Now, this is hardly a profound insight. Right? Here we see an interstitial phase, a moment where a state lacking conviction in itself comes into confrontation with a people who, as somnambulists, dimly sense the lie of the state and oscillate between sleep and wakefulness, unrest and discontent. So to conclude, you'll be happy to know, what deserves more attention and exploration is Gandhi's worry over recovering an idea of the proper, and his concern with the forms of immanence rather than merely accepting the synchronicity of the times of the colonial and the modern. And here we have Ajay Skaria's magnificent work. I mean, it's in recent times I've not read a more profound engagement with Gandhi, and it's more at a level of at a philosophical level. And as Ajay reveals in the book and in private conversation, he has to set Gandhi aside, right? So he speaks about the entailments of Gandhi's thought. It's not about what Gandhi actually said, but what Gandhi can be made to say in adept hands. Arguably, Hind Swaraj is less a manifesto, a credo, or a diatribe against Western civilization. It is instead a text that tussles with a late Victorian inheritance of the crisis within liberalism in Europe, a growing disaffection with its imperial form in India, and disquiet with the forms of popular politics that challenged the imperial formation in India. In many senses, Gandhi embodied Nordau's new conservative, mentioned earlier, in a search for the proper form of politics and self-making for which there was no immediate resolution. Uday Mehta has dwelt upon the idea of postponement rather than agreement, stressing a mode of reflection that is characterized by the idea of patience that the text constantly puts forward as an exemplar to the reader. It also allows us to think with the gnomic injunction towards the end of Hind Swaraj, and I quote, "It is no easy task to do away with a thing that is established. We therefore say that the non-beginning of a thing is supreme wisdom." Now, it's this kind of statement that actually Ajay Skaria spends a lot of time unraveling for us, and that is the power of the book. Because obviously a statement like this is not immediately revealing of some fundamental truth. What does it mean to say that the non-beginning of a thing is supreme wisdom? It's not about advocating quietism and so on, as we know Gandhi's life was anything but that. Hind Swaraj is a text written by an eminent Victorian who, while thinking with the experience of the intransigence of imperial racism, has not yet disavowed the idea of imperial citizenship. There is a struggle between an inheritance of the anxieties and the detritus of late Victorian thought and a resurgent politics of the indigenous, the idea of Indian civilization, which explains the aporia, the raggedness, and the unsystematic nature of Gandhi's thinking. Located in the crucible of the experience of South Africa and the transition to a new imperialism undergirded by race, resonating with a liberal critique of empire that originated from India, and written in an interstitial oceanic space aboard a ship, Hind Swaraj represents an articulation of the limits of Victorian liberalism and its anxieties.